Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Director's Box podcast, episode 5 of the podcast now. If you've been with us for the first 4, you'll know that I'm Kev, and I'll be joined, as always, by Craig Gill. Craig, hope you're doing well and enjoyed the weekend.
Hi, Kevin. Hope you're well, too. Yeah, I'm great. Thanks. Yeah, had a good weekend. Obviously, football orientated, both coaching and games, and got to watch some Premier League as well. So, yeah, a great weekend. Thank you.
I'm watching Premier League myself, enjoyed certain moments of it. One in particular, I'm sure that everyone will appreciate, when Luton got a late equaliser. We spoke last week, actually, didn't we, about AFC Wimbledon in the 95th minute. Well, the scenes at Crystal Palace in the Luton away end was exactly the same, only my back didn't appreciate it. Someone must have ploughed into me. I've got right old pain in the back, but I'm good now, Craig, and I'm ready to go, raring to go for another exciting podcast.
Yeah, hope get well with that back, Kevin. It clears up soon, mate. Don't want you on the injury list.
Yeah, there's enough on Luton's injury list. I've just had to say to Rob, sorry, mate, I might have to sit Wednesday out, but I should be fit for Saturday if needed. And if we are needed, then Luton are in trouble. Believe you me, my footballing abilities is not of that level. Coming up on this episode of the podcast, we will look back on that great game on Sunday between Liverpool and Manchester City. One of the fallouts from it, actually, was defending corners. So as I've got a coach alongside me, I will get some coaching insights into just how to defend corners. What are the pros and cons of men on the post, zonal, man marking? Should you leave men up? Should you bring them all back? We'll discuss all of that. We'll also look at the number of late goals in the Premier League this season. Already with 10 games left to go, there's been more 90-minute winners or injury time winners than any other Premier League season. And we'll look at just why that might be the case. And then we'll delve into the EFL, where there was a surprise just over a week ago when Accrington parted company with John Coleman, a man who's been associated with that club for 23 years as a manager. So we'll discuss that. We'll then look ahead to a game that I'm sure is very close to Craig's heart, the Welsh Derby, which takes place Saturday lunchtime. And it's FA Cup quarterfinal weekend in England this week. So we'll have a look at all 4 games before reflecting on the news that Neil Warnock departed Aberdeen. That's all to come. But let's look at Liverpool against Manchester City, Craig. We built it up last week as a huge game in the title race. Arsenal had already overtaken both of them at the time. We thought Manchester City might edge it. And in the first half, that's exactly how it looked. But credit to Liverpool, they came back. They fed on the mistake from Ake and Edison. Got their equaliser. Two really good good teams. And draw was probably a fair result. Although Liverpool might be a little bit disappointed that they didn't win, given their second half dominance.
It was a proverbial game of two halves, Kevin, wasn't it, really? Obviously, City enjoying much the better of the first half. And Liverpool coming good in the second. Interesting that Guardiola took off De Bruyne particularly. And obviously they had words on the touchline. But he brought in Kovacic because he said it was quality of ball distribution and his accurate passing, which, Kevin De Bruyne isn't that, then I'm not sure who is really. But I think he wanted a more to solidify the midfield and taking De Bruyne off. I think obviously there's always a partial risk and reward with the way Kevin De Bruyne plays and some of his passing. And I guess he just didn't want to get hit on the counter should they lose the ball, with obviously Liverpool so dangerous in transition. So yeah, it was a fantastic game of football, obviously. Unfortunately for me, I was coaching, so I didn't get to see it live, but made sure I caught up with it that evening when I got back in. But yeah, great game of football and, a great advert for the Premier League. But of course, as you say, the draw left it then wide open for Arsenal to see whether or not they could take the 3 points against Brentford, later on.
Yeah, the title race now, you've got Arsenal leading the way, Liverpool second, Manchester City in third. And after the international break, we've got that Manchester City against Arsenal game. Yeah, it's left it beautifully poised, I really think. The one maybe concern for Manchester City, it looks like Edison's going to be out 3 to 4 weeks with the injury that he ended up going off it when he tackled Nunez for the Liverpool penalty. That could be significant because obviously he's not just a goalkeeper. He's probably the most accurate passer of a goalkeeper I think the world has ever seen. And he's so important to launching Manchester City attacks. So it'll be interesting to see how they cope with that. Obviously, they have the FA Cup this weekend and then an international break, so he might not miss as many games as maybe he might have done, but they'll want to get him back pretty quickly, Craig, I would imagine.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, he's he is a world-class goalkeeper, obviously, hence why he's playing for the current champions. But his distribution of the back is a key aspect of Manchester City's play, isn't it? The way they play out from the back. So he'll be missed both for his distribution, but also for his goalkeeping prowess as well, obviously.
Yeah, let's come on to the Manchester City opening goal. Then you mentioned Kevin De Bruyne a moment ago. It was him standing over the corner. The first thing that you kind of look for as a supporter, really, is anyone on the posts? There wasn't anyone on the posts, and it was clearly a training ground move or something that Manchester City had scouted from Liverpool anyway, because they blocked off Alexis McAllister at the front post fairly, I think. Nathan Ake just sort of stood his ground, really, and created a huge chasm of about 6 yards out for Kevin De Bruyne, probably the best deliverer of a dead ball in the country, to pick out John Stones, and Stones was exactly where the ball went, and he kind of fired in from close range. It's a really, really clever corner.
Yeah, it was extremely well worked, wasn't it? I was listening to an interview with John Stones after the game, and he said they'd only worked on it a couple of days before the game, but they realised that Liverpool tend to keep defenders quite high without swinging corners. So what they did, obviously, they set up for that, for an outswinging corner, obviously with De Bruyne being a right-footed player taking the corner from the right side, but then of course Liverpool then defended quite high in the area as a consequence. They then isolated the near post, and Aki was very clever in easing out the near post defender, which then allowed the ball to be played in expertly, actually, along the line by De Bruyne for John Stones to step in front of his defender to finish.
Yeah, really well worked corner. Obviously, John Stones, brilliant goal from their point of view. But ultimately, if Liverpool had a man on that front post, Craig, none of it happens, does it? Because he's just there to boot the ball away. It seems to be a out of fashion thing at the moment, men on posts. But from a coaching sort of perspective, are you a coach that likes players on posts? And if so, do you cover both posts, one post, and which post would you cover? How do you kind of, where are you with regards to men on posts at the moment, or ladies on posts?
I think it's very coach dependent, isn't it? Obviously, you look at the way teams set up in all leagues, really, and a lot of coaches, are different. Obviously, maybe I'm a little bit old fashioned, but I like to have both posts covered. But what I tend to do, I tend to put the left back on the right post and the right back on the left post, and in that way, then their strongest foot is on the inside of the goal. So that obviously their shoulder will be up against the post. So in the right-footed fullbacks situation, obviously his left shoulder will be up against the post, the left post, so that his strongest side then is defending the goal, if you like, and then vice versa, obviously, for the left back. So yeah, I personally like to see fullbacks on or defenders, don't have to be a fullback, obviously, on posts. Then I like to man mark runners. Touch tight, ideally, not allowing them 2-3 yards run on you. But if you're gonna man mark players and they're on a run, then I prefer to be touch tight and mark them. And then with the spare players, then I then to get them to mark zonally on along the 6 yard box. So I'll have one sort of near post in the hole in the near post, or just in front of the near post, to stop the one that's under hit. And then I'll have one middle of the goal, and then one level with the far post. And then, obviously, depending on how many they bring up, then you man mark accordingly. I like to keep one up. I like to keep a striker up, just so that if you do get the ball forward, you've got the potential of a counter attack. But also, if you keep a striker up, then generally they'll keep two defenders back. I've known coaches who keep three players up, which then means, of course, that they probably have to keep a minimum of three, if not four, defenders on the halfway line, in around the halfway line. But what that does then, of course, then that opens up space in the box. So if you've got lots of defenders in the box, obviously there's less space for attackers to run into and to exploit. So there's that consideration as well. So yeah, a few nuances there, a few options, if you like, for coaches. Other coaches like to have one defender on the near post only, and let the goalkeeper deal with the far post, the middle of the goal and the far post. And then others, as we said earlier, don't have anybody on the posts. And I think we can all relate to goals we've seen where you think, well, if he's got a defender on the post there, then that probably doesn't go in, you know. But it is horses for courses, and it is it's very subjective from coach to coach and team to team. But as I said, personally, I'm a little bit old school, but I do like to have that defensive solidity. Players taking responsibility for their opposite number by marking, and then with the spare players over, then one in the hole in the near post to cover that space, and then everybody then just maybe blocking runs or certainly challenging along that 6-yard line. And obviously, if the keeper comes then, if he comes for the cross, then those defenders then drop onto the goal line to offer protection should he get out-jumped or, should an attacker beat him in the air, for example.
I mean, I'm absolutely delighted that the current craze is for no players on posts, because Luton works so hard on set pieces. They knew it. Rob kind of said it before a ball was kicked in the Premier League this season. We can't go toe-to-toe with these teams in the Premier League from a technical standpoint, because obviously we're from the Championship, they're Premier League. But the one thing we can match them on in every single game that we play is set pieces. And Luton, I think, are the third highest scoring set piece team behind Liverpool and Everton, I think, are the other ones in the Premier League this season. But so many of those goals wouldn't have gone in had there have been a man, particularly at the back post, because Luton do target the back post a lot more than they do the front post. And they've got a great set-piece taker in Alfie Doughty, who finds tall players, sort of Carlton Morris, Eli Adebayo, even Ross Barkley's got a decent spring on him, and defenders. And the amount of goals that we've scored, particularly at that back post, is just incredible. And now, kind of as teams have got used to it now, what Luton do is they still target the back post, but teams have generally got two sort of taller players heading towards the back post because they've scouted out our set pieces. So rather than go for goal, Carlton Morris will be at the back post, the striker. He'll head it back across goal, and someone in the middle of the goal therefore has got more space to himself for a tap-in. That was a goal that worked against Aston Villa recently. It's just, what's the sort of downside of having men on post? Obviously, it's two players that can't mark other players, but there has to be a reason why coaches don't want players on posts. Can you give us some insight into what that might be?
Yeah, obviously, if you take two defenders out of the box, if you like, out of other defensive responsibilities, then clearly you've got two defenders down, and of course when you are, it then becomes a numerical situation then, doesn't it? And obviously the opposing team have got a numerical advantage with runners to trying to get on the end of the on the end of delivery, and probably then spare players certainly on the edge of the box and even around the back, ready for any knockdowns or any scraps off the goalkeeper, off defenders, or anything. If anything is not finished cleanly, then obviously you've got more numbers from an attacking perspective in and around the ball, albeit that the defending team have got two defenders on the line, hopefully trying to stop the ball going in.
Yeah, hopefully. I've seen many a defender on the post just go dozy and ball still goes in. So I suppose from that point of view, that might be a reason why coaches have abandoned that. It's defensive set pieces dealt with. Let's have a look at attacking set pieces now. How is your preference with attacking set pieces?
Yeah, I always favour in-swinging corners because obviously by nature of the delivery, the ball is on its way towards the goal anyway. So then you'll often see with in-swinging corners, the slightest of touches, whether it be head or volley or any other part of the body actually, and the ball flies in the back of the net by the nature and the trajectory and the pace of the in-swinging delivery. Other coaches I know prefer an outswinging corner to take the ball away from the goalkeeper and then look for potentially a second ball then. So, you mentioned Luton do it. The first contact is then back across the goal potentially for a second contact to finish the action. So, again, it's very subjective, Kevin, but I'm very much in favour of, with my attacking set pieces, of the ball being swung in towards the goal, and then I have runners running across the trajectory of the delivery, looking to get a contact on it. As I said, with the pace on the ball, usually doing enough. If you get a good contact, that's normally enough to certainly cause problems for the goalkeepers and if there's any defenders on the line.
Yeah. And then so one other sort of scenario would be short corners. Sometimes teams would use kind of short corners, presumably, I'm guessing, to bring defenders out of the box to mark the guy or cover the guy who's taking the receiving the short corner. Would that just be to allow sort of attacking runners more space to run into rather than anything else?
Potentially, yeah, absolutely. So normally if you take a short corner, obviously you need a minimum of two players. So then by default, the defending team would normally send two defenders out to deal with those two players, because otherwise they'll just pass around a single defender. So that would take two defenders out of the box, potentially. But also, of course, short corners are used if there's a height disadvantage to the attacking team. So it would be potentially fruitless to deliver a ball into the box if you're playing against a team who's got a height advantage against you, because you're probably not going to win that first or second header anyway. So then teams look to play short, to play around and to try and combine in a different way to capitalise on that corner.
Really interesting corners. I mean, as I say, more and more, I mean, teams now are actually employing specific coaches, aren't they, to work purely on set pieces. It's a huge part of certainly English football. And, you know, even when I watch football from other leagues, set pieces are a massive, massive part of the game. So the amount of work that goes in on it, and I'm fortunate enough that I've sat in or I've observed a few Luton training sessions, and Luton do work an awful lot on set pieces, both attacking and defending. And you only have to look at their record against it to see that it's working. It's a huge part of the game. And it was just an interesting thing that sort of came to prominence really in the biggest game of them all on Sunday. So it was nice to be able to get your thoughts on exactly how sort of coaches think.
There are stats around which say, you know, between 25 to 33% of all goals are scored from set pieces. So when you consider that, that's a fair percentage between a quarter and a third of all goals are scored from set pieces, then it's no surprise why coaches spend so long in set piece, or should perhaps spend so long on set piece preparation. And, you know, interesting to see or to hear you say that Rob Edwards is a huge advocate, clearly. And that's paying dividends for Luton this season in the Premier League.
Another thing that's kind of coming into the game a lot more this season, Craig, is late goals. Now, yeah, a lot of that is going to be down to the fact that we're into this sort of period where lots more time's being added on. But generally, in recent weeks, I've noticed we're kind of going back to sort of 5 or 6 minutes of injury time in a second half. So we're only talking sort of 1 or 2 minutes more than what we were in previous seasons, yet we're getting a hell of a lot more late goals. I have my own theory behind this. I think it's down to the 5 substitutes as opposed to sort of before COVID it being 3 substitutes. But I've heard, you know, a lot more sort of things like stoppages for VAR, maybe sort of making teams more tired and having to sort of pick up after long stoppages and things like that. Have you got any sort of anything that could be a reason behind it?
I think you've probably mentioned the main aspects. I think having 5 substitutes now instead of 3, obviously that's gonna, it works both ways, doesn't it? Because obviously you can have fresh legs for the second half particularly, but of course that can go for the defending team as well as the attacking team. So I'm not sure about that one. Fatigue on those players that have started the game, obviously, and will finish the game, especially with now the games going to 98, 99, 100 minutes. But then again, you'd think that, you know, with the sports science and the conditioning that we have in elite football these days, that players clearly will be able to play beyond 100 minutes. And indeed, in cup games, when it goes to extra time, they have to play for a minimum of 120 minutes anyway. So, players will be conditioned to that. A lot of it, of course, is concentration, and it's a psychological aspect. You know, coming to the ends of games, it might be that, you know, players switch off from a set piece or are undone by a particular, you know, piece of skill. And of course, then it might be that doing those latter piece, latter stages of games that you want to get your, you know, your most attack-minded and skillful players in possession that cause problems against high defenders.
Yeah, and I guess it's just also game situation as well, isn't it? I mean, one of these late goals, you know, I was witness to on Saturday when Luton scored in the 96th minute and Crystal Palace were clearly getting deeper and deeper to hold on to their win. And obviously, in turn, that invites Luton to send more and more attackers into the penalty box. And, you know, law of averages said that a cross was going to land at some point, and it did. And Corley Woodrow scored and sent everyone mad in the away end. So, you know, if you're kind of holding on to a win, and maybe you're a team like Crystal Palace who don't win as many games as perhaps they'd like to, so a win is even more important, particularly at home, sometimes you just invite the opposition in one too many times, and that's what happened on Saturday.
I think, yeah, absolutely. And again, by going deeper and deeper, that's a psychological state of mind, isn't it? It's nothing to do with fitness. Although you could say, of course, if you, you know, if you're a team like Liverpool, for example, who high press from minute one, then can they sustain that for 99, 100 minutes? Well, clearly they do at times because they take their rests at appropriate times during the game and rest with the ball as well, of course. So there's that to consider. But, you know, as the old adage as well, that obviously, you know, attack is the best form of defence as well. So by teams dropping deeper and deeper, you know, a mid-block, for example, you know, defending sort of like just in front of the halfway line, that might be a sensible approach. But of course, it all depends what the opposition are doing, you know. And if Liverpool, you know, you've got a team like Manchester City who are consistently probing and penetrating in possession, then obviously that's going to be more difficult to defend than a team that maybe looks to play long, and it might be easier to deal with a longer ball. That said, of course, you know, the Luton goal at the weekend came from a long wide cross into the box, which was great delivery. And then a glancing head into the far post got you the point. So what you would say then is, a coach, well, we've got to stop the deliveries into the box, because if that delivery doesn't come into the box, then obviously we haven't got to deal with the header.
Yeah, there was so much Crystal Palace could have done with that goal. I mean, they had the ball to start off with. Most teams take it into the corner. They didn't. They were trying to sort of pass it around, and Luton were pressing them and managed to get the ball off of them. And then, like you say, there was no attempt to stop that cross whatsoever. Eze kind of dangled a leg as a sort of token gesture. Didn't really try and stop it. And then, you know, if Woodrow hadn't scored, if you see the goal back, if Woodrow hadn't scored, there's four or five queuing up behind him, depending on how long the ball was into the box. Someone was going to put a header on target, and in it went. Yeah, Luton are very, very good at scoring late goals, Craig. I think they're only behind Liverpool in terms of scoring goals after the 75th minute in the Premier League this season. Now, I know that as well as Rob Edwards targeting set pieces, the other thing he said that we can be with regards to all of these teams is the fittest of all of these teams. And that's something that seems to come home quite a lot, because a lot of Luton goals are in the last 15 minutes of games when, like you say, other sides might be kind of getting a little bit sort of tired and a little bit sort of their concentration goes. Luton keep on going, and if Luton do stay up this season, believe me, it will be these late goals that keep them up, because they got a 93rd minute equaliser at Notts Forest earlier in the season, 94th minute equaliser at Burnley, and a 96th minute equaliser at Crystal Palace. That's three defeats that have earned 3 points, all in injury time this season. So there's a huge part in late goals. You've got to go right to the end in this game.
You certainly have. And playing devil's advocate, how many goals have Luton conceded in the last 5 minutes of games, 5-10 minutes of games, out of interest?
Yeah, no, you're right. You are absolutely right. Arsenal scored a winner. Liverpool scored an equaliser. Aston Villa last week scored in the 90th minute. So it is a two-way thing. Generally, when Luton have conceded, they've been ahead. So against Liverpool, against Arsenal, and it just goes back to what I was saying. If teams not used to winning, they kind of drop deeper. They're clinging on for dear life, and these good sides, they punish you. And that's, yeah, I think that's what it is. I think there's an awful lot more of that. There's some weaker sides in the division that 3 points mean everything to, and they just drop deeper and deeper and deeper. And late goals are coming as a result. It's great for us fans because you're getting action right the way through. It's not so much great for those who like to beat the traffic and disappear early, because you're gonna miss a key goal. But I've never left a football match early yet, and I definitely won't be doing it this season, that's for sure. And that would be my recommendation. Stay to the final whistle. You definitely won't miss a goal then.
For sure.
That's for sure. Let's move on, Craig. News broke just prior to when we recorded our last podcast, actually, that Accrington have parted ways with John Coleman. I mean, John Coleman's been at Accrington pretty much as long as I've been interested in football, it seems. He had two spells. He had a 13-year spell first time around from May 1999 to January 2012, where he left to join Rochdale. And then he returned again in 2014 up until 9 days ago when he was relieved of his duties. So 23 years over two spells, 1,098 matches he was in charge for at Accrington Stanley. He won 436 of those. He drew 276 and he lost 386. So that's an incredible record for a team who in League Two, they got promoted to League One as champions in 2018. That earned him the Manager of the Year award in the whole entire EFL that season. He's been massive for Accrington Stanley. So that news was quite a surprise when it broke, because it's not like they're going to get relegated, Accrington. They've not been on the greatest form, but they're certainly not going to get relegated or anything. And he's just been a sort of mainstay of that club, really.
Yeah, he has, hasn't he? And, you know, he's done a terrific job, as you say, and you're bringing him into the league, non-league. And then getting them promoted to League One, their highest ever, you know, their highest ever standing as a football club, in all the years that they've been going. Yeah, as you say, at the moment they're 17th on 47, and Colchester United in 23rd place, occupying the second relegation slot on 32 points. So they're 15 points above the drop, as you say. Their form hasn't been great though, and I'm sure that might have had a big bearing on it. And it was interesting, just playing devil's advocate, you know, I read a piece by Andy Holt, the Accrington Stanley chairman, who said that obviously, you know, both manager John Coleman and his assistant Jimmy Bell, they were sacked because of a combination of poor performances and public disagreements. And I think this was something to do with a new contract, I believe. And he goes on to say that, you know, all said and done, you know, they've been terrific for the club. You know, they've done a wonderful job there over the many, many years. But that they did perform badly during the relegation season from League One. And unlike other owners, he showed loyalty to them and didn't sack them then. But of course, now they're having on a bit of a bad run in League Two. And with everything else that's gone on and what's been said, reference I think it's contract negotiations or whatever, then the chairman has decided to give them their notices.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously his prerogative, isn't it? He's the owner of the club. He can do as he sees fit. It's going to be very, very weird watching an Accrington Stanley side not coached by John Coleman. As I say, it's been the best part of, with the exception of maybe 18 months or so, it's been the best part of a quarter of a century that club's been run by John Coleman. And obviously Luton came through the leagues, you know, they got relegated into the National League in 2009, back into the league in 2014. So they were regular sort of opponents for Accrington for the first sort of 5 years or so of making our way through to the Premier League. So we came up against them quite a lot. They were always a competitive side, whether they had, you know, great players or whether they were sort of in amongst the lower budgets like they would have been in League One. They were always competitive. They always got stuck in. They very much similar to how Luton are doing in the Premier League this season. They use their sort of facilities or lack of to their advantage. And if a manager has maxed out what was possible at a football club, I think it's fair to say John Coleman and Jimmy Bell, his assistant, it should be said, definitely did that with Accrington.
Most definitely, you know, and they've reached the potential and more probably, given the size of the football club. Interestingly, though, I think they've only won three games in this calendar year. They've lost their last three, and I think they've only taken 5 points out of the last 21 available. So current form obviously isn't great, over the last 8 to 10 weeks also. So that could also have a bearing as well. No, fantastic servants to Accrington Stanley, and I'm sure everyone at Director's Box wishes them both well for whatever role they're going to take up next.
Yeah, you wouldn't think John Coleman's going to be short of offers based on the job he's done at Accrington. It'll just be interesting to see what Accrington do over the next few months. That's one to keep an eye on for sure. Something that I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on this weekend, Craig, is the South Wales Derby, the two biggest clubs in Wales, they meet this weekend, Swansea City against Cardiff City. Obviously, from in your part of the world, that's a massive game, isn't it? At the Swansea.com Stadium. Swansea still not quite safe in the Championship, although recent results have sort of elevated them to a point where they're not in immediate threat of danger. Whereas Cardiff are on a bit of a surge, aren't they? That incredible turnaround against Ipswich at the weekend means they've won their last four matches now, and they sit just 5 points off the playoffs going into that game on Saturday. It's the first game on Saturday, so they'll have a chance to move within 2 points of the playoffs. Just before we get into the sort of how it might go and which way the result might go, just how sort of passionate is that other games between Swansea and Cardiff?
I think it's well recognised as as one of the most bitterest rivals, I think, certainly in British football. Although I have had the honour and the pleasure of watching an Old Firm derby up at Ibrox, obviously against Celtic, and that was pretty vociferous, to say the least. But it must be very similar for you with Luton and Watford, I would imagine, with your rivalry. But the South Wales Derby really is a keenly contested and much anticipated fixture. And no doubt the first games that Swansea or Cardiff fans look for once the fixtures are released in June. No doubt. And I'm sure that this weekend, won't be any different. Interestingly, that up until a couple of seasons ago, neither team had done a league double over the other in over 100 years of that fixture. Swansea then did the double 2 years ago, and again repeated that feat again last season. So they did the double-double, if you like. But Cardiff City, with Aaron Ramsey as a new signing, beat Swansea at the Cardiff City Stadium earlier in the season, 2-0, when Michael Duff was the manager at Swansea City. So it remains to be seen at the weekend whether or not Luke Williams, the new Swansea City manager, can come in and continue the great work that him and his coaching staff have done in turning around certainly the performances. They're back to playing the Swansea way now, if you like, which was enhanced with Roberto Martinez and the way he played his way out of League One, particularly when people said he couldn't, and then taken on through the stages then with Brendan Rodgers, Michael Laudrup, obviously, to great success, and sort of 7-8 seasons in the Premier League with a major trophy, having won the League Cup under Laudrup, and then obviously playing in Europe in the Europa League and playing the likes of Napoli and beating Valencia away. So, all those accomplishments, not that many years away, actually. But of course, all counts for nothing. History counts for nothing. It's Saturday's game, which is important. Cardiff will be looking to do their own double, their first double on Swansea City. And it all makes for an intriguing game, one of which I'll be watching here, tuned in at 7:30 in the morning across the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's always, I love watching these derbies when it's not your club involved in them, because obviously it's just win at all cost when your club are involved in them. But I love watching these derbies. I love seeing the passion of the fans, and it's always, they're always great occasions regardless of the size of the derbies. I mean, we mentioned last week AFC Wimbledon and MK Dons. That's obviously not a geographical derby, but it's a derby for both those sorts of clubs for the historical reasons that we outlined. I guess here, though, the motivation for Swansea is massive. Not just stop Cardiff doing the double over them, but really and truly, if Cardiff don't win that this game, that's going to be a huge dent to their promotion hopes, and no Swansea fan will want to see Cardiff pushing towards the playoffs.
No, you're not. Yeah, I think the way that Luke Williams has gone in, as I said, with his coaching staff and reverted back to the possession-based football that enabled by Russell Martin before he went to Southampton. Then they brought in Michael Duff, who played a more pragmatic way, shall we say. So Luke Williams has gone back in, and they enjoyed, I think, over 70% possession against Bristol City, for example, last weekend. Bristol City, ironically, we were talking about it earlier, scored from a set piece and won the game 1-0. So albeit that Swansea have brought back the possession-based football that they're known for, it's important now, obviously, that they start converting that possession into goals.
Yeah, I watched a bit of the Swansea game against Watford the midweek before, and the first half, they could have been out of sight. 2, 3, 4, they missed some really good chances. And then, funnily enough, like you just mentioned, they conceded to a set piece in the second half of that game as well. So that might be an area that Cardiff target in this game. A huge game down in Wales, both for the two teams involved and actually for the picture at both ends of the Championship. So I fully recommend that if you're not doing anything Saturday lunchtime in the UK, stick Sky Sports on and watch that, because they're games that rarely disappoint. They're always, well, it's going to be massively contested and important at both ends of the table. Alternatively, if you don't want to watch that game, and why would you not want to watch that game, but if you don't want to watch that game, the FA Cup quarterfinals are on this weekend, Craig, and unfortunately my team Luton bowed out of this competition in the last round. Just took Kevin De Bruyne and Erling Haaland to put paid to them. So Manchester City were the ones that went through, and they're probably involved in one of the marquee quarterfinals. But before we get to their game, I think the standout one is keeping on the rivalry theme. Sunday afternoon, when Manchester United play host to Liverpool, it's always a historical fixture that between two teams that don't have the greatest amount of love for each other. And obviously Jurgen Klopp's last FA Cup, Manchester United would love nothing more than to dump him out at this stage and progress themselves. Whereas obviously Liverpool would love to beat Manchester United and make it to Wembley for the semi-final. So that one's got all of the sort of historical and present story context behind it. It should be a good game of football.
It should be, shouldn't it? And yeah, it's one which I'm looking forward to. If I can't watch it live, I'll certainly be catching up on a recording. I think it's got the hallmarks of being a classic FA Cup quarterfinal. I still think that Liverpool will have too much for Manchester United, albeit at Old Trafford. But of course, it all depends on what team Liverpool put out. You know, we know that they've got injuries, but the young players that have come in have done exceptionally well. Proved they're in the Carabao Cup final by beating Chelsea 1-0 a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, and then of course, then on Saturday you've got Wolverhampton Wanderers against Coventry. So that's a local Midlands derby, obviously. Mark Robbins doing a great job at Coventry. But of course, likewise, you know, Gary O'Neill doing a great job at Wolves as well. So that could be a great game to watch for the neutral as well. Another derby, another local derby, which could well be worth a viewing on Saturday lunchtime. And then Saturday tea time, then you've got Manchester City against Newcastle United. That's a 5:30 kickoff. Again, you know, two teams which of late have had a good rivalry as well. Manchester City, obviously, probably the stronger of the two, certainly on current form. Newcastle not enjoying a great spell recently. But of course, it's the FA Cup, as they say, and anything can happen in the Cup. But I just see Manchester City winning that one. And then on Sunday at lunchtime, you've got Chelsea against Leicester City. And again, I just think that the Premier League side might have too much for the Championship side in that one. Albeit Leicester, of course, are, you know, at the top of their division and have had a great season.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think we're getting to the stage of this competition now where we don't need to worry about sort of teams resting players or anything like that. The one win from Wembley, everyone's going to go full strength or as full strength as they possibly can, depending on their injuries and things like that. The Man United-Liverpool game has to be the standout tie. Of course it does. But the one that interests me is the one between Wolves and Coventry. Probably two sides who, at the start of the season, wouldn't have expected to be at this stage of the FA Cup. No disrespect to them at all. I mean, to be fair to Wolves, they've already taken out Brentford and Brighton, so they've done themselves no harm at all in making their own way to this quarterfinal. They've taken out two Premier League teams. Whereas Coventry had it slightly easier, didn't they? They got the sort of plum draw, without any disrespect, of Maidstone in the last round, who'd obviously had their day in the sun when they beat Ipswich in the round prior to that. But someone's going to be at Wembley who didn't expect to be at Wembley, Craig. And Coventry tasted Wembley last season in the playoff final. They'll probably want to taste it again in the playoff final this year. But they would love to get back there. Whereas Wolves, huge club in English football, got a rich history of this competition way back when, probably feel that they themselves deserve to be there now. And the season that Gary O'Neill's having there, they probably do deserve to be at Wembley. You just wonder if their injuries are starting to hurt them. I saw Pedro Neto went off recently as well. He's huge for Wolves. So add in the fact that it's a sort of rivalry game. Of course, Wolves have also taken care of fellow rivals West Brom in this competition. There's a lot at stake there, and I wonder if that might just be the most competitive game of the weekend for me. I really am looking forward to that one.
Yeah, so am I. As I said, I'm really looking forward to watching that one. Yeah, Wolves sitting ninth at the moment in the Premier League, only 2 points behind seventh place, which is West Ham, for that Europa Conference slot. But of course, you know, if they do well in the FA Cup semi-final and the others qualify for Europe anyway, there's potential for they could qualify through that route as well. But no, Gary Neil's done a great job at Wolves, hasn't he? And, you know, I do think they'll be too strong for Coventry. But, you know, having watched Mark Robbins' Coventry over the years, actually, and coached against them when they were in League Two when I was at Newport, they'll be a force to be reckoned with, and I'm sure it won't be one-way traffic for Wolves. And I'm sure, with it being a local derby, it'll be keenly contested as well.
Yeah, Coventry fans don't need to despair. The last three times Luton have got promoted, Coventry got promoted the next season. So, you know, you're on course for promotion this season, Coventry fans, regardless of what happens on Saturday. Yeah, Mark Robbins, absolutely incredible job that he's done there, taking them from League Two to within a kick of being in the Premier League last season. Thankfully, from my point of view, that kick went wide. And I'm enjoying a Premier League season. But yeah, really looking forward to those games. I agree with you. I think we're looking at Wolves, Liverpool, Manchester City and Chelsea as the four sort of teams to progress to the semi-finals. The big problem Newcastle have got, not just Anthony Gordon's injury on Monday night. They beat Manchester City in the Carabao Cup, didn't they? And once you poke this bear, they don't forget about it. They come out at you, and that's the last thing you want to do. And at the Etihad as well. I just don't see where Newcastle can repel this Manchester City side.
I don't think so, Kevin. And we spoke about Man City for the last 2 weeks now, haven't we? And I just think they've got so much quality across the park and in each of the units. And I think it'll be a Man City game. Having said that, you know, with a goalkeeper out through injury, you never know.
That's one crumb of comfort for Newcastle, but another excellent game. Should be four really good quarterfinals, and of course they're all done on the day. This time round, extra time and penalties if needed. They'll all be finished Saturday and Sunday. We'll finish off this podcast then, Craig, with a brief thought on events in Scotland. We mentioned last week, actually, we sort of covered Neil Warnock going to Aberdeen. I kind of questioned why. You gave me perfectly valid answers, which it now leads on to the fact that you were correct, because after Aberdeen won in the Cup last weekend, he promptly announced that he was going to leave Aberdeen straight away. He's left his position. But the one reason why he said he's left his position is because he's assessed the club. It needs a huge overhaul, and he believes that that overhaul needs to start earlier than the summer. So he's vacating so that they can get someone in to begin the overhaul as quickly as possible. So when you said last week that he was going in to look at the club as a whole, you were spot on.
Well, it's certainly one which is a strange situation, isn't it? Because, you know, you brought Warnock in as the caretaker manager for what I thought was the end of the season. He hasn't won any of his six Scottish Premiership games since he's been there. He's got them to the semi-final of the Scottish Cup last weekend, and then announces that he's leaving to allow another manager to come in before the end of the season. So it's all quite strange, really. But maybe just that, Kevin, as you said, maybe he has gone up there, had a look behind the scenes, and realises that someone needs to come in on a permanent basis imminently to address many issues, none more so than the relegation fight that they got, sitting in 10th position, 4 points above Ross County in 11th for that one relegation position. So, Aberdeen certainly by no means safe. And Neil Warnock resigning his position weeks, really, after taking on board what everyone thought was a roll to the end of the season.
Yeah, very, very strange. It seemed strange at the time, kind of seemed strange right throughout. And as you say, the timing of it, having just got them through to the sort of Scottish Cup semi-final, even stranger, really. But, you know, that's strangeness does tend to follow Neil Warnock around. And has done here. It'll be interesting to see how Aberdeen fare. They've obviously got an international break coming up after this weekend to address everything and get a new man in place and try and make the turnaround begin. It does need to begin, doesn't it? They, like you say, they're in a precarious position, but at least they've got that cup semi-final to look forward to. So there is some sort of comfort a little bit down the line. So yeah, Neil Warnock gone from Aberdeen. And as we mentioned earlier, John Coleman gone from Accrington. And one other managerial departure in the last few days, Valerian Ismail left Watford. He's joined a huge growing gang of people to be employed and spat out by Watford. And Tom Cleverley has taken over at Watford. It'll be interesting to see how he does, and indeed if he is there until the end of the season. Been promoted from their under-21s, but yeah, not a great track record with managers, Watford, albeit my club are benefiting from one of their sackings, so I'm not going to be too critical of that. That's it for this episode of the podcast. If you're going to a football match this weekend, do enjoy it. As we always say, enjoy it, but please be respectful of everyone else. Craig, how's your weekend looking?
I've got trainings all weekend, Kevin. We've got no games this weekend in preparation. We've got spring break coming up here in the US, so the schools close and people tend to take family holidays over this period. But then we've got league games starting then. We have a spring league for our boys' teams. The girls' teams play in the fall. So, yeah, we're in a pre-season situation, if you like, really. With our game starting in April. So we've got trainings all weekend, but I'll certainly be keeping an eye and hopefully watching the FA Cup games particularly. And of course, there's no way I can miss the South Wales Derby and the game at the Swansea.com Stadium.
Yep, huge game that one. Wish you well with the trainings. Hope that all goes okay. Luton v Nottingham Forest for me this weekend. Massive game at the bottom of the Premier League. Luton can either really give it a right shake-up down there, or they could fall further and further adrift and maybe put one nail in their coffin. Hopefully it's the former from my point of view. Of course, if you're a Notts Forest fan, we understand if you wish it to be the latter. We will be back next week. Just because the international break is around does not mean to say that the Director's Box podcast has a break. We'll be back. We will look at various different things over the 2 weeks of the international break, one of which will be a look at the non-league scene. And of course, we'll cover the internationals in line with the fact that Wales have a huge, huge couple of games as they bid to qualify for Euro 2024. But that's all for next week. Thank you very much for listening to us. Craig, thanks for your company for the last 50 minutes or so. Really, really appreciate your insights, particularly with that corners. It's great to get the insights of someone who sort of coaches in the game, just to help fans understand a little bit more about the thinking that goes on at certain set pieces.
Thanks, Kevin. No, my pleasure. And I've thoroughly enjoyed this edition and wish you good luck at Nottingham Forest at the weekend and wish everybody an eventful and hopefully successful weekend with their respective clubs as well.
Absolutely. Until next week, from Craig and myself, goodbye.
Goodbye.